Well, there were a couple of questions about how in the world I could come up with a sermon topic that had the words evolution and tragedy in them. Am I going to come out strongly against evolution? No. So let's all go have some carbs. The Memorial Day, it's a time when we're supposed to be conscious. We're supposed to think about the price paid by the people who came before and by some of the people in this room who risked body and soul, who gave body and soul, that we might be here today. It's a time to be appreciative and mindful, and I think much more. Nobody said it better than Lincoln, which is why I have paper in front of me. And I'm going to give you the whole thing, because although everybody heard it in elementary school, it really bears listening to, because it is the finest memorial written in the English language. We could argue some things from Henry V, and you can go back to Pericles, but this is pretty nuanced, and it has a couple of threads going on in it that may not be immediately obvious. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that the nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we do so. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we will take increased devotion to the cause for which they gave the last full measure of their lives, and that we highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, and that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. There are two strands going on here. One of them is to honor the people who fought, who struggled, who died, their courage, their dedication, their willingness to be engaged in a great struggle. Of course, it was seen as a great struggle from both sides. And that's the second strand. The ultimate sadness and absurdity of war. The understanding that it may at rare times be a tragic necessity that people have to give that last full measure of devotion. But there is a sense in here of a deep sadness, a sense of the absurdity of so many of the wars that we fight. It's an acknowledgement that we fight, even as a nation and beyond being nations, as brother against brother, brother against sister. There is only one humanity. And we fight these wars, mostly young men, now increasingly young women, because there's no such thing as a front line anymore. And most of the time, what our wars are marketed as are not what they are about. And much of the time, if not all of the time, the people who are there in the trenches, who are fighting, who are bleeding, who are killing, who are dying, do not understand the ramifications of the struggles that they are engaged in. We, to quote a Dylan line, we all fight with God on our side, everyone convinced of the rightness of his or her call and duty, and that is mostly unexamined, and it's mostly far more nuanced and complex than what we are told and how our wars are marketed. The Civil War, yes, was about slavery, but there were an awful lot of people in the North who were not particularly committed to civil rights and human rights. And there were people in the South for whom it wasn't about slavery. It was about a struggle that was economic and about independence and about federalism. It was about an awful lot of things that we simplified and sometimes oversimplified. When we fought World War I, and there was a war to make the world safe for democracy, and later on a war to end all wars, people were involved in these great conflicts. And that Kaiser had to be stopped, and that Kaiser was stopped. And instead of sowing peace at the end of World War I, we sowed the seeds for World War II, a larger and more tragic and horrific conflict. We fight all these wars and seldom have an understanding of how they are going to come out and what does it mean to win and what does it mean to lose. Many of you will remember an old book and not a very good movie called The Mouse That Roared, and the theory of this was that a small country that had nothing was going to declare war on the United States because losing a war to the United States was probably the best economic move that they could make. This may not be true anymore, but it was the conceit of the book. It's hard to tell the winners and losers. When you go to Europe now, who are the winners and who are the losers? We are so malleable in the sense of how we feel the passion of the moment during times of war. Before World War II, the Soviets were really, really bad. The Germans were kind of slipping away. We were a little afraid of the Japanese, but the Chinese were our good friends. During World War II, when Hitler turned on Stalin, Stalin, the monster, became Uncle Joe. And then after the war, we hated him again. And after the war, the hated Japanese became our friends. And those good Chinese for whom we fought became our enemies. We are a malleable people. And while the passion seems so deep at the time of good and evil, it can change in weeks because we are also subject to a lot of propaganda and conditioning. We do it with individuals also. These days, we really don't fight people, a people or a country. We fight crazy leaders. It's really remarkable. If you are against the United States at any given time, your picture is going to show up in the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disease because we had all of these great friends, well, like Stalin, who was an enemy, then a friend, then an enemy. I guess we call them frenemies now. And we had Batista, we had Trujillo, we had Saddam Hussein for many years, the Shah of Iran, all who were our good and Mubarak, all who were our good friends, later became our enemies and later became crazy, according to us. All of this is to say that most of the time, our oversimplifications, our Manichaean desire to turn and to view the world as always the good guys against the bad guys, misses the subtleties of what human beings are about and can be about, and the choices that we have. When I look at the world, I don't try to see it, or I try not to see it, as the good guys versus the bad guys. There may be times when war is a tragic necessity, where somebody really does want to take your life, your home, your sacred honor, but you got to be a little careful about that honor thing, because the less people have, the more their personal honor means to them, and the more prickly and defensive we tend to be. But when I'm looking at how this world seems to operate, and how we as a nation operates, and really most nations, I'm struck by wondering, why is there so much war? Why is it so easy to gin up anger and fear and xenophobia and racism, to see in such broad categories, and then to march off against that terrible foe of the moment? I have always believed, as long as I've been an adult, that evolution succeeds because there are benefits that are conferred as we evolve, that there are survival benefits in human behavior. And so when I turn that question into wondering about war, I have to ask what seems to me to be a totally absurd question: what is the survival benefit of war? It must have something, or we wouldn't have been doing it as frequently, as constantly, as universally in every economic society. Every religious society, every secular society has found ways to get into violent conflict with one another. So it's got to come from somewhere within the genome. And I think, and that's why I pose the question of the tragedy of evolution, that it's what got us here. That we are not as swift as gazelles. We are not as strong as elephants or woolly mammoths. We are not as fierce, mostly, as lions. Sometimes we are. And so in order to live, in order to eat, in order to survive, in order to prevail, human beings had to learn how to cooperate. Because one person is not going to tackle a mammoth. It's not going to work out well. One person is not going to chase down a lion. It will work out well for the lion, not so much for the person. So you had to learn how to cooperate in the hunt, which meant that you also had to cooperate in sharing the food. And even a dozen people cooperating to bring down a mammoth, they're not going to do it so well just hand wrestling. So they picked up stones. They fashioned clubs. They whittled spear points. And thus was born the military-industrial complex out on the pampas of Africa, in the savannah of Africa. We learned how to cooperate to hunt. We learned how to defend ourselves to protect what we had. We learned how to distrust the other tribe because they might want our food or our children or our women or our homes or our territory. Whether we were being Bedouins, nomads, or settled in agricultural areas. We learned how to take that stone and fashion it into an arrowhead. How then, after a spear, to put a stick that magnifies the distance and the impact of that spear. That's complex technology. We learned that copper made a fairly decent weapon, but not after those other people escalated by creating metallurgy and steel that cut right through the copper. And then people built forts and dug moats, and other people created ladders and catapults. And this escalation, using our intelligence, using our big brains as they evolved these systems to protect, to defend, to take, to fear, to do all of the things that are problematic in our world today. The evolution that got us here, the weaknesses that we combined to do the hunt into strengths, those strengths have also become our weakness, as we now have the ability, both by war and non-war, to kill each other, to pollute our atmosphere, to use up our resources, and to make conditions basically unlivable. And how will we learn to mindfully compensate for all of those traits that got us here, those things that had survival benefits, that everyone here, our DNA, crawled out of that primordial sea and somehow got here by not losing? We're the winners. All humanity, everyone on this planet, is at this end stage so far of a victorious march, but is it a lemming march to a cliffside and into something that is not good? We don't have time physically to evolve past where we are today. But we do have time to morally evolve, to have a mindfulness about what our world is, that there really is only one world, there is really only one humanity, there's only one atmosphere and one sea, one water source, and we are all dependent on it, and we all share it. This is our blue boat home. And whether through war or industry, we put it all in peril. Now, I said we don't have time physically to evolve past our fierce and warlike inheritance and legacy. But the good news, the hopeful news that I want to leave you with is this. We are in geological time children. In astronomical time, we're really in utero. We are the teenagers who have the keys to the car and the key to the gun safe. And that's dangerous. You all know that that's dangerous. But most teenagers do survive. And we will survive or not together. We've got those keys. We've got that car. You may have seen the horrible story yesterday about the young girl, her first day getting her driver's license and her first solo. She was killed. Texting. Telling everybody she just got her driver's license. We are an immature race. We can be mindful of that. We can compensate for that. We can try to walk gently on this earth. And with a mindfulness that 67 years from now, our descendants will be here and will turn back to us with gratitude that we endeavored, that this experiment as a nation, this experiment as a species, shall not have perished from this earth. And it is up to us. On Memorial Day, we don't simply honor the past. We need to learn from it, to take from it its lessons, the strands of heroism and the strands of sadness and the strands of absurdity, and weave ourselves a net that will save us in the future, because we are the ones who will create the future by instinct, when we hear the drums of war beating and the bugles playing and the flags flying, or thoughtfully, when we look at our own hearts and our whole earth and the whole humanity that we share with everyone else on this planet.